Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of gastroesophageal cancers with Dr. Samuel Klempner from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. This is the third and final program in our series, and we also have some additional faculty who participated in a survey that we're going to show you later on. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey we post in the chat room for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of our meeting here tonight. We do new webinars all the time. On November 29th, right after Thanksgiving, we'll be doing one on biliary tract cancers, which should be a lot of fun. And then, as we do every year, we'll be heading out to San Antonio for the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. We'll be doing three meetings out there. If you're going to San Antonio, stop on by and check it out. If not, check it out online Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and then Thursday night of the week of December the 5th. And then from there, we'll head over to the ASH meeting, where we're going to be doing four symposiums. Also, if you're at ASH, check it out. If not, we're going to be hanging out all day, all night with us from 7:30 in the morning until 9 at night. We're going to do four different meetings covering a variety of hematologic cancers for you to check out. Next March, we'll be reawakening our weekend-long General Medical Oncology Summit here in Miami, where we're located. That should be a lot of fun as well. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Philip on papers from ASCO. But today we're going to talk about gastroesophageal cancers and, of course, reflect back on the recent ESMO meeting that we've been talking about in a variety of cancers. There's a lot of great stuff happening at ESMO this year. And then looking forward to the big GI cancer symposium in January. As we always do, we'll be talking about some uses of these agents outside of indication. And we're going to be presenting cases. I meet with these docs. Most of these are general medical oncologists. And we put together many videos to present cases. We'll spend about half our time talking about the cases from these docs. So here's where we're heading tonight. We're going to start out a little bit retrospective on ESMO, but also about some of the papers that Sam has been involved with. Then we'll go through the cases, then the survey, and then more papers from Dr. Klempner. So first I want to get your take. We've talked a lot in this series, Sam, about zolbetuximab, and of course we're waiting to see whether it gets approved in the first-line setting. But there are a number of questions that come up about this currently unapproved anti-claudin 2 agent. And one is whether or not you can use it in relapsed disease. And I pulled a couple of papers that you were involved with prior to the first line paper, where there was a lot of experience using a bunch of combinations with zolbetuximab. Do you think that if the drug does get approved, first of all, do you think it will be approved? And if so, can you see in those patients who sort of miss it first line, picking it up second line?
Yeah, great question. Certainly an exciting time for gastric and esophageal cancer patients to have potentially new drugs. With two positive, essentially parallel phase three trials that prolonged PFS and OS, you know, the spotlight and glow, I think everybody is fully expecting that in January, this drug will become a new tool for all of us and our patients. So I do think it will be approved. To answer your second question about, you know, lines and if there's going to be greater activity in one line or another, you know, just to clarify, we really haven't seen any data for any post-zolbetuximab claudin strategies, and we don't have a great grasp of what the landscape of post-zolbetuximab therapy looks like. Is the target still retained? Is there any changes to the tumor at the time of progression? These are big questions for the field. But I think there's enough reason to think that these agents could be deployed at multiple lines of therapy. You know, even 10 days ago on the ASCO plenary series, we saw the ADC CMG901, which is an MMAE payload ADC against Claudin, and it was given to later line patients. Of course, none of them had had prior zolbetuximab or other Claudin, but certainly it was active in the later line. And this trial here, you know, we looked at single agent and combination with Pembro in heavily pretreated patients, and clearly safe. In this particular trial, there wasn't a ton of activity in the very small cohorts. I do think chemo is still important in that context. But yeah, I think it's going to be, I think we're going to have Claudin-based approaches across multiple lines of therapy, whether you continue Zolbi post-progression, whether you switch to other Claudin agents are going to be big questions for the field.
I thought it was interesting that these studies also included, as you say, combining it with IO. What do you anticipate people are going to want to do if both Claudin's positive and PD-1 is?
Yeah, I'm sure you've asked everybody this question, and it's a totally fair one. What I think will probably shake out in practice is we know the activity of FOLFOX and checkpoint inhibitor or 5-FU platinum and checkpoint inhibitor from multiple phase 3 trials. So I think we're going to see these patients. It's going to be a real clinical question for all of us. I think in the PD-L1 high patients, there will probably be a breakdown more towards 5-FU platinum and checkpoint, maybe CPS greater than 5 or greater than 10. And then in the PD-L1 negative patients, which is still a substantial portion of our patients, I think there will be a clear place for zolbetuximab in that space over checkpoint inhibitors. And then in the in-between, it's really going to be a case by case. I think the bridge of that is really to establish combinations of perhaps the triplet with 5-FU, oxaliplatinum, zolbetuximab, and immunotherapy. And there's several ongoing frontline trials that are examining exactly that question. So maybe if you ask me this in a year, I may have some answers to some rationale to maybe we can just do all of it. So I think that may be the future pathway.
I'm wondering if I ask you in a year or two, there's going to be other things like FGFR that are going to be on the list.
Yeah, certainly those two phase threes are ongoing, and we eagerly await. I mean, the phase two data looks very encouraging, and it's just another, you know, another slice of the pie of our patients. So, you know, we're getting closer to like the lung cancer investigators you interview, where we're slicing up our, you know, disease into biomarker enriched cohorts.
Here's another question I've asked a bunch of people. I'm curious how you would respond. For docs who, you know, wake up one day and they find that zolbetuximab is approved, what are the major messages you're going to deliver in terms of tolerability and using the drug?
Yeah, I think the first message is really a very important one, which is we're going to need to test. You know, I think some commercial companies are already doing testing. And then I think a lot of pathology labs, whether big commercial labs or institutional labs, are debating how they're going to onboard Claudin 18.2. Because if we have this approval, you know, we're obligated to know that result for our patients. And so testing is going to be the number one thing to introduce everybody to get familiar with first. Claudin agents, as essentially as a class, most of them do have nausea and vomiting as the main adverse event profile. I think it's a learning curve, just like we've learned to use multiple medications through oncology and honestly, people who practice and see patients, I'm going to be asking them too, what have they done and learn from, you know, the whole community. Personally, with some experience with these drugs, I would say slowing or interrupting the infusion can often mitigate the nausea and as a strategy to consider. The trials actually argued against dexamethasone in the first cycle, but I think in practice people will use steroids, and that may help mitigate some of the early nausea, because if you remember, most of the nausea in these trials was early on in like the first cycle. And then typical antiemetic strategies, and there may be some unique approaches that this may open to. It's kind of interesting if you look at the data, you know, people without a stomach, their toxicity was a little bit, they have less nausea and vomiting because presumably they don't have the on-target, off-tumor binding of zolbetuximab.
That's really fascinating. I mean, it's a completely different pathophysiology that oncologists are used to thinking about with CNS nausea. So, yeah, exactly. Everybody, the first thing people, when I ask that question, everybody immediately lights right onto the nausea. And hopefully people will be able to get people through those initial cycles with less of a problem. So the other thing I want to ask you about, and I see this paper here, anytime I see bispecific, I get all excited, particularly in solid tumors, because, of course, you know, we talk about it all the time with lymphoma and myeloma. But any type of immune therapy, and I know there are a lot of things targeting Claudin, CAR T, et cetera. But what about this bispecific? So this isn't a typical CD3 type bispecific, but like a different type of immune bispecific?
Yeah, interesting. Had the pleasure of being involved with some friends and colleagues on this trial, and this was presented by one of our friends, Jeff Koo, at Memorial at ESMO just recently. But I think taking a step back, you know, when we have a relatively tumor-restricted protein like Claudin 18.2, it opens up the possibility of multiple strategies with some built-in specificity, whether it's ADCs, bispecific BiTEs, CAR T, etc. And so this is really an example of one of those strategies where you're leveraging the 18.2 to essentially deliver the drug towards towards the tumor cells. And then on the back end, you have this co-stimulatory molecule 4-1BB, which essentially drives T cell proliferation. And there's preclinical data for this drug. There's a nice paper in Jitsi. And now there's some clinical support for this drug as well, including this, you know, this nice partial response that you've shown here. This drug does seem to be well tolerated to date, and certainly the trial is ongoing and may expand into other lines of therapy as well. We'll wait to see how the drug is developed. But again, I think it's just proof of principle for another strategy of targeting or leveraging the understanding of Claudin.
But I mean, also at a macro level, it's using an ADC, which everybody associates with delivering chemo, to deliver an immune product.
Yeah, right? Super cool, I think.
Different than chemo. So, and then speaking of very different, what's DKN-01? It kind of seems similar to what you were just talking about, now being combined with an IO tislelizumab as well as chemo first line. I'm a big fan of cool trial names. I like Distinguish, but anyhow, what is it?
So it's, you know, this is along the theme of, I think, even if you look at some of the CheckMate 649 and CheckMate 577 data, that biomarker data, you'll see that the composition and some of the cell types in the tumor microenvironment actually have an impact on how responsive these tumors are to checkpoint inhibitors. Of course, T cells are ultimately the key effectors, but there's a lot of other cells in the microenvironment, and myeloid cells, macrophages, Tregs, myeloid-derived suppressor cells, etc. And so DKK1 is a secreted protein. And at concentrations, you know, elevated concentrations, it essentially drives an immunosuppressive like soil around the tumor. A lot of Tregs, a lot of MDSCs, a lot of M2-like macrophages. And so similar in concept to bevacizumab, if you were to soak up all the DKK1 from the environment, these immune cells are no longer getting a stimulus to be immunosuppressive. And it is a much more favorable environment which to introduce a checkpoint inhibitor. So I envision this drug as really a very nice complement to potential checkpoint inhibition with chemo. And I think it's an immunomodulatory strategy to try to reprogram the microenvironment.
So I wish I could understand all this, and I hope the audience understands more of the translational issues here, but it looks really interesting. All right, let's get back to the real world here and the kinds of questions that come up every day in clinical practice. Start out with an 80-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Brenner. Here's the case.
This is a patient who had been in relatively good health previously, presented with a metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lower esophagus involving non-regional lymph nodes as well as a right hip, high PD-L1 60. She received therapy with FOLFOX with nivolumab, and we then transitioned to 5-FU maintenance together with nivolumab. And after multiple cycles, we elected to discontinue the 5-FU and transition to single agent nivolumab. My questions for the investigators are, what is the role of IO therapy in esophageal G-junction gastric tumors in patients who have low PD-L1, typically less than 5, and particularly those patients where PD-L1 is less than 1? when the investigators use maintenance therapy, do they use 5-FU alone? Do they use 5-FU with IO therapy, or do they ever use IO therapy alone? And do they have a preferred IO therapy based on data to be combined with chemotherapy in patients who have adenocarcinoma versus squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus?
So take your shot at clarifying the use of IO that no matter how many times I hear it discussed, I always find hard to kind of comprehend, but give it a shot.
Yeah, yeah. I think you could have a whole session on this case. It highlights a lot of areas. So first, I would completely agree with the way Dr. Brenner managed this patient. It's exactly what we do off protocol. CPS 60 is kind of a no-brainer here, FOLFOX and Nevo. And then that's the exact maintenance strategy that I tend to transition to. I do generally continue the 5-FU, you know, drop the oxaliplatin after 6 to 9 cycles, continue the 5-FU and the Nevo if patients are tolerating. And then sometimes we drop to nivolumab monotherapy in people who just want to break from chemo, and it allows you to, you know, give potentially Q4 week visits, which is convenient for patients doing well. So first would do exactly the same thing. In patients who have the other end of the spectrum, the low PD-L1, or the easy answer is the CPS less than 1 patients, where really it's hard to find a data set that supports that use when we look at the subsets and PD-L1 strata that have been reported. So my own practice is relatively consistent with the ASCO guidance that was issued, you know, now maybe 6 or 9 months ago, where in PD-L1 less than 1 patients, and certainly we're obligated to make sure that, you know, this has been reviewed by a pathologist who knows how to do this, and when we tend to stain them ourselves in-house, I will not give checkpoint inhibitor for those patients. I think FOLFOX alone, I'm not convinced that addition of checkpoint adds survival without toxicity in that patient population. The 1 to 5 is really where I think the heterogeneity is. Greater than 5, I do tend to offer checkpoint inhibitors to my own patients. In terms of agents, because that was one of the questions, nivolumab and pembrolizumab are the drugs we have approval for, so those are the ones we're generally reaching for. I don't have a strong preference between the two. Often comes down to convenience and sometimes anatomic location. There's a little more data for true esophagus for pembrolizumab. But the 1 to 5 group, I find myself struggling with, so I know that all of us struggle with this. We know that our pathologists can kind of make a 3, a 6, or a 2, a 5, just because it's just not the easiest test. It's quite subjective. And so at some point, you have to decide how you're going to practice. You know, are you going to use the number that was given to you and take it as the ground truth and act on it? Or are you going to think that there is a lot of regional heterogeneity in PD-L1 expression, and a 3 is still, there's some positivity. You know, we saw the recent rationale data with a greater than 1 as the cutoff. And so I think the negative is easy, the high positive is easy, and then the middle is really almost a case by case. Of course, we have a lot of patients who come in expressing a desire for this, and I don't blame them at all.
And if they say, you might have a medical oncologist as a patient, if they say, well, the FDA approved this, and I maybe there's a chance that I'll get a long-term response, are you okay with it or not really?
Yeah, I think in the CPS negative patients, I really tend to have a significant conversation with those patients and try to explain why I think this is not going to be of significant benefit to them. On a trial, I am okay with it. But have I done it in a negative patient periodically? Yes, I think anyone has probably done that.
One of the key words I heard you say was the word struggle. And one of the most common reactions we get to our work is that people like it when they hear investigators not knowing the, you know, like struggling, and they realize they're not alone. They're not the only ones who can't figure out what's going on. You know, you guys hear this stuff all the time, and it's still a challenge. I want to go on to another case. And when I was thinking about this case, I ran across this case record from the New England Journal, the MGH, which is, I think I remember reading these things when I was a medical student. I always loved these case records, you know, like the international grand rounds, I think, for hospitals is at MGH. And I saw this one that you did, and you were telling me, I was curious, you were telling me this is actually a live meeting that's been going on for a million years at sort of a grand rounds for MGH. We'll get to that in a second, but here's the case that got me thinking about the case you discussed in the New England Journal. A 61-year-old man who's a patient of Dr. Rudolph.
This is a sad story of a 61-year-old gentleman who happens to be the father of someone that's starting Hemonc Fellowship, believe it or not, presented with worsening dysphagia and was noted to have a GE junction mass. Pathology was moderate to poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. Sadly, he had ongoing worsening dysphagia, severe pain, significant nausea, to the point where he was miserable. And I switched three different treatments, hoping to get him some response locally with his symptoms. And finally, the patient just opted for supportive care. I had extensive discussions with the surgeon really right from the beginning. I would love to know if the faculty have encountered any similar cases where they have proceeded with esophagectomy despite a metastatic disease just for quality of life and debulking.
And that kind of seemed like what happened with this case that you discussed in the New England Journal. First of all, any thoughts about her comments? You know, she was frustrated because the patient was miserable. She wanted the surgeon to do some kind of palliative surgery. I don't know if you hear this story often or not.
Yeah, we do. I'd say the most common scenario that I've encountered is often a distal gastric cancer, you know, near the pylorus, where people have gastric outlet obstructive symptoms. And if they're not having a substantial response to systemic therapy, which is always what we start with in the setting of advanced disease, then I think we do want to explore, because if you can't palliate that symptom, it's really difficult to get patients through any substantial amount of therapy. And I'd say I've explored things like axiostenting, which is essentially like a gastro J done endoscopically with sometimes with good results. Essentially, it's a bypass without the open operation. But I've had a few patients where in the distal tumors where the surgeon feels like the morbidity is maybe a little bit lower than an esophagectomy, we have done, you know, distal subtotal gastrectomies in the context of peritoneal disease, small volume, or isolated liver metastases, when it's truly going in open eyes with the patient that, you know, this is not a curative intent operation. This is a palliative surgery. And as you have up here, this is essentially exactly what happened in this case. This patient had more of a diffuse type gastric cancer, which are often difficult and perhaps a little less responsive to our standard therapies. And that's exactly what ultimately happened, is to, in the setting of a stable disease after systemic therapy, and a lot of discussions about the pros and cons, ultimately did undergo a resection. And I can actually update that this patient, you know, from a year ago there, is actually still doing well after surgery.
That's great. So I'm so jealous that you got to work with the New England Journal illustrators. That must have been a lot of fun. I love those illustrations you did there. And the audience, so check out the paper. Anything else you want to say about this case?
No, I just think it highlights that, you know, these are things that really happen. And sometimes palliative operations do improve the quality of life and allow patients to get more therapy. And so that happened to work out in that case.
So I would like you to listen to another case by actually your colleague, Dr. Strickland, who did his fellowship there with you and now is joining your staff. But we love getting cases from him, and we work with him during his fellowship. Here's a 69-year-old man. Here's the case.
This gentleman came in with atypical chest pain, and he did develop dysphagia that was progressive, and he ended up being intolerant to solids. On EGD, a large fungating mass was seen in the distal esophagus. Biopsy showed poorly differentiated invasive adenocarcinoma. On PET CT, there was intense FTG avid signal in the distal esophagus, as well as some upper abdominal lymph nodes. Specifically, gastrohepatic and pericelial nodal stations were involved, but there was no evidence of distant metastases. And so for this patient with biopsy-proven adenocarcinoma in the distal esophagus and gastroesophageal junction with local regional lymph node involvement, what neoadjuvant and or perioperative therapeutic paradigm would you recommend for a CWRT1 gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma. And how would this change if the anatomic location and classification were more consistent with a CWRT 2 or 3? This question is really getting at the active controversy surrounding neoadjuvant chemoradiation approach that Cross introduced versus a perioperative approach that the FLOT4 trial introduced.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, again, very common scenario that everybody in practice sees. I think in the setting of clear malignant adenopathy, like that PET image that was shown, my first message is really, I think systemic therapy is the backbone. We know that these cancers have high risks of recurrence, and generally that is believed to be secondary to micrometastatic disease. And so I and our practice would almost always start this patient with systemic therapy. I think FLOT is the more common approach that we would take in more frail patients, have definitely, you know, utilized FOLFOX in that setting a little bit more along the lines of like the CALBG 80803 trial, which was sort of a PET adapted, but at least provides some justification that outcomes with FOLFOX looked favorable. I think serial reassessments, so we would generally do like, you know, 4 cycles and then get a new PET. And sometimes after discussion with the patient, we will follow the systemic therapy with chemoradiation just like 80803. I would say that's a little more common in the very proximal tumors, more like true esophagus. But in CWRT 2 and 3, I personally am more on the side of FLOT in that population. I also think the quality and the experience of the surgeon makes a big difference. And so people who do a lot of these and do them very well and have good dissections, chemotherapy is probably adequate. There's some thinking and some data that, you know, chemoradiation may help sterilize the field or overcome an inadequate operation. I think that's becoming less common as surgeons become better and better and have more and more experience. But in general, to answer the question, our neoadjuvant approach would be most likely FLOT in this scenario. The other thing I would highlight that wasn't mentioned is that we really do need to test these people for MSI high in the non-metastatic setting, because that's a 10% of the patients, and it's really an entirely different paradigm.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about that. So, of course, one of the questions people ask you talk about FLOT is the question of IO. And actually, we saw some data at the ESMO meeting, finally, looking at this question, maybe not definitive, but one study, I think it was called the Matterhorn study with durvalumab and another with Pembro. So finally, we have some data to look at. What did you think about it?
Yeah, so this was really exciting data at ESMO. I think we've all been looking forward to these trials. So to back up, there was 2 phase 3 trials presented at ESMO, both with a very similar question, which was, does adding PD-1 to perioperative therapy, or in the case of Durva, PD-L1, improve outcomes? And so the trials were all designed with a couple looks. And so the first thing they looked at was pathologic complete response as sort of an early readout of biologic activity. And then, of course, event-free survival and overall survival. And so KEYNOTE-585 was a pretty good sized trial. There had a lot of interim analyses, and we can debate about how that impacted the outcome. But essentially what they showed is that there was a numerically improved and statistically significant improvement in pathologic complete response. So the portion of people who had no visible cancer cells on the primary tumor at the time of surgery. However, that did not translate to an improvement in event-free or overall survival in the data that was shown. We can criticize the trial and the design and the nuances, but Matterhorn is a similar concept, except it used FLOT for everybody. 585 had many patients with cisplatin 5FU or platinum 5FU, whereas everyone is FLOT plus Durva on the Matterhorn trial. So it's a little cleaner, a little bit bigger. And what we saw in that was, again, an improvement in pathologic complete response rate with chemo plus durvalumab over FLOT alone. But we have not seen the event-free survival or overall survival. I think we're all hoping that that will come out, you know, at a meeting in the near future. So as of right now, do we use perioperative PD-1 on a routine basis? No. Am I very tempted if I see someone with a stage 3 tumor and we happen to test PD-L1 and it's 20? Do I seriously think about it? Yes, I think it's tempting and there's good rationale, but we don't do it routinely yet.
All right, well, let's move on to another story that came out at the ESMO meeting related to HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer. And Dr. Zanetta Lamar has a 55-year-old man with HER2-positive recurrent disease, and here's the case.
This is a 55-year-old Iraqi veteran who was exposed to burn pits and developed difficulty swallowing. Endoscopy was performed and showed invasive, moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. HER2 was positive via immunohistochemistry. PD-L testing actually was not performed at the time of diagnosis. When he was initially diagnosed, scans confirmed metastatic disease. He began therapy with FOLFOX plus trastuzumab plus pembrolizumab. Recent scans confirmed progressive disease. And what do you do in the second line setting? Do you prefer like remucirumab and paclitaxel versus fam-trastuzumab?
What are you thinking?
With this particular patient, I would want to give HER2-directed therapy.
So I'm curious about your thoughts about second-line therapy for HER2-positive disease, how you define HER2-positive disease, and also the 811 trial story that's kind of evolved over the last couple of years that's been so interesting, where this patient got, like, you have to be an oncology historian to know that this patient got treated in that window of time when the FDA approved the use of Pembro regardless of PD-1. Because there were only a few patients in that original cohort that were PD-1 negative. And then, of course, recently, actually, they just approved it now, I think, fully, but only in PD-1 positive patients. So any thoughts about first-line therapy? And then, of course, we'll talk about second-line.
Yeah, great case. And notably, you know, these burn pits that a lot of the servicemen and women have exposure to that Dr. Lamar raised have been a risk for veterans. And the Department of Defense actually funds a fair amount of esophageal cancer and gastric cancer research, and they're obligated to do so because of the, you know, real world risk factors that the servicemen and women encounter. So interesting background.
Could I just ask, what's a burn pit?
I'm not in the military, so I don't know all the nuances, but I believe it's exactly what you think. You know, material burning exposed to potentially toxic fumes. Could be materials, could be wood, concrete, etc.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, please continue. Sorry.
No. So this, as you alluded to, we continue to learn about this combination. So really, really nice trial, really nice study design for KEYNOTE-811, essentially asking the question of, does adding Pembro on top of FOLFOX trastuzumab improve outcomes? It clearly improved response rate that led to the initial approval. And they didn't have progression-free or overall survival at that time, but it was approved for everyone. As time emerged and in the supplement of the original paper, you could see that the very small portion, like, you know, 12-15% of patients who were PD-L1 negative, they had not a really big difference in response rate between the two arms. And then that sort of played out in the progression-free survival data too, where the overall trial on the intent to treat, meaning everybody, was positive for progression-free survival improvement. But if you look at the subgroups, it was only the PD-L1 positive patients that were getting progression-free survival improvement. And so the FDA, I think maybe last week or even within the last week, amended the pembrolizumab label for HER2-positive patients, where now it's FOLFOX plus trastuzumab plus Pembro only for PD-L1 positive, which was defined as CPS greater than 1 in this study. So I think this patient was treated very reasonably. It sounds like the PD-L1 was unknown at the time, but in that window, we would have done the same and given it sort of regardless of PD-L1 expression, and then progressed. And unfortunately, that does happen to the vast majority of our patients. I, like Dr. Lamar, often tend to reach for TDXD as my second-line choice in a HER2-positive patient. in academic institutions, at least in my own practice, we do often send circulating tumor DNA and do a biopsy to try to see if we can convince ourselves that the tumor is still HER2 positive. But certainly we've given this to patients who have maybe, you know, technically HER2 low or HER2 negative tumors on repeat biopsy. I have done that. Taxol-Ram is still a reasonable choice, and there is a trial called Destiny Gastric 04, a big phase 3, primarily run outside of the U.S., which is head-to-head comparing TDXD versus Taxol and Ram in the second-line setting. So we may actually get some data in the relatively near future.
So we actually had Dr. Van Cutsem on the last issue of this series, and we're talking about his TOGA trial, chemo plus trastuzumab. I'm curious what you would do with a patient who gets, you know, TOGA. It might have been before all this started with 811 or, you know, even since then, and just gets trastuzumab chemo, then progresses, but it's PD-1 positive. So would you consider an IO second line or go more, like you said, TDXD?
Yeah, I think those patients do exist, as you suggested. You know, these windows happen, and it happened initially too when the label was withdrawn for late line therapy. Kind of, we didn't quite have first line at the time, so there were these patients in this window, and so I think immunotherapy alone is not particularly active in microsatellite stable gastric cancers and esophageal cancers, period. And so I would not give immunotherapy alone in the second line. It's tempting to expose a patient who's PD-L1 to immunotherapy at some point in their disease course. I would still probably give TDXD or Taxol-Ram as second line in this situation. I would definitely look for a trial with an immunotherapy containing approach. And there is a phase 3 trial that will be opening in the future, and there is some phase 2 data looking at Taxol-Ram and Nevo, and we have seen some data with safety for TDXD and checkpoint inhibitors, so it would be tempting to think about those types of combinations, but I would definitely want to expose the patient at some point, but probably would still go with the standard second line.
So I want to get your take on one more case, and then I want to show you some of the survey that we did, a couple of your papers, and we have a few more cases. We'll see if we can get back to them. But this is a very interesting, unusual case. I'm curious what your thoughts are about this 63-year-old man who's a patient of Dr. Dayani.
So this was baffling to all of us. Hispanic origin gentleman, 63, generally healthy guy. Clinically, it's a T1B. N0M0 grade 2, stage 1, lower esophagus. So really the recommendation is esophagectomy, which we then had. And that's what came back. Moderately peripherally differentiated adenocarcinoma, 9 of 13 nodes positive. So it goes from a stage T1B, stage 1, to a stage 4A due to T4 and 3 diagnosis. It was highly surprising. How often is it that you go from a stage 1 to a 4A, despite really state-of-the-art standard workup? Are there stage 1 esophageal or lower esophageal cancers where you would consider preoperative treatment? How often do you actually do diagnostic staging laparoscopy for stage 1 disease, if you do any? And then now we're faced with this lower esophagus, had the surgery. What do you give in the adjuvant setting? Is there a role for radiation? And because this is sort of lower esophagus G junction, would you consider including at some point adjuvant nivolumab based on CheckMate 577?
Any thoughts on this one?
Yes, I know Dr. Dayani, and he's very good at what he does. He is a GI oncologist, and I think this happens. You know, we do see this. I think it's always humbling that our clinical staging is not particularly sensitive in the early stage cancers, meaning we do see pathologic upstaging not too infrequently. And I think it's a lesson, you know, that we all are continuing to learn, that we need to seriously think about neoadjuvant therapy probably for some of these even somewhat early clinical stage cancers. It's particularly relevant in the diffuse gastric cancers where, you know, we'll basically do a laparoscopy for everybody because I think it's an infiltrative tumor with a high degree of peritoneal spread. And even if the EUS says it's a T1B or a T2, I will often favor laparoscopy for that situation. For true esophagus cancers, we do not do a staging laparoscopy routinely. I know that was part of the question. But in this clinical scenario where you have someone who has node-positive disease, no upfront therapy, so technically would not have been included in CheckMate 577, but what we would offer this patient is adjuvant CAPOX or FOLFOX in general. I think if the PD-L1 was particularly high, I would be tempted to add checkpoint inhibitor, although we did see a negative trial called Attraction 5 that in gastric cancer, where they took people upfront surgery, node-positive patients, and randomized them to adjuvant chemotherapy, you know, with or without PD-1. And there was no improvement in the three-year survival rates. And so I think FOLFOX or CAPOX would be the standard answer for adjuvant. We would not do adjuvant radiation unless the margins were positive, which I didn't hear on that case. So we would generally give adjuvant FOLFOX CAPOX for 3 to 6 months.
So let's go through some of the survey we did of investigators. You know, this is our way of doing consensus. If everybody says the same thing, we call it a consensus. If you get three different answers, well, maybe not so much. This one in general looks like people have a consensus in terms of post-cross adjuvant therapy using nivolumab regardless of PD-1 therapy, PD-1 level, and using it for a year. Any comments about that and any reservations about using it in PD-1 low patients or zero?
I think, you know, the data was the data, and we do tend to offer it to everyone. There was my one comment is actually kind of a scientific and interesting one, is that Dr. Kelly, who ran CheckMate 577 at, I think, World GI back in June, presented data where among the patients who got neoadjuvant chemoradiation and then they had their surgery, a good portion of them, I think somewhere in the 40% range, had actually an upregulation of their PD-L1. So their scores increased. And if you look at the people who had PD-L1 increases after chemoradiation, they did even better. So I do think there's a relationship between PD-L1 expression and the benefit of adjuvant nivolumab. But these are post hoc analyses. And so in real practice, what we do is follow CheckMate 577 and offer adjuvant Nevo essentially regardless of PD-L1 expression.
Do you see a future for neoadjuvant IO in addition to MSI high, but MS stable?
Yeah, I think Matterhorn will hopefully answer this question to some degree, the neoadjuvant component. I think adjuvant chemo is hard. FLOT adjuvant chemo is hard. And so, you know, pushing even towards more neoadjuvant, you know, total neoadjuvant approaches like we've learned from our colorectal and rectal colleagues, you know, may ultimately come into play more commonly. I think there is still an interest in checkpoint inhibitor in the neoadjuvant, including combination with some of the biomarkers, whether we'll do, you know, KEYNOTE-811 in the neoadjuvant or Claudin plus Nevo in the neoadjuvant. All these things are on the table. I do think that combinations with chemotherapy and radiation and checkpoint inhibitors, at least learning from our lung colleagues, it doesn't appear that radiation and checkpoint inhibitor has quite played out the way that I think we were all hoping it might, at least concurrently. But, you know, we don't have that data as much in gastroesophageal. We certainly have a bunch of ongoing big trials looking at for definitive therapy, particularly in squames, looking at chemo radiation with checkpoint followed by checkpoint on the back end, even in unresectable patients. So the roles for checkpoint inhibitors in the non-metastatic space may continue to expand.
So here's a question we've been asking ever since checkpoint inhibitors came out, and it's evolved from I don't know to, I guess, a kind of a consensus, yes, which is, is there a correlation between autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit?
Yeah, you know, it's obviously these retrospective analyses are confounded by multiple things, but there does appear to be a trend. It you know, reminds me of like the old debate with the EGFR inhibitors, cetuximab and panitumumab. You know, if you get the rash, does that mean you're going to be more likely to benefit? And there was, you know, data both yes and no. I think we see the same kind of thing. There's a lot of really large data sets where you can tease out a lot of things. And my own take of the data, and it's not my exact area of expertise, is that there does seem to be a relationship between immune-related adverse events and outcomes in a positive direction. But I don't know that we have the same level of data for stomach and esophagus that I've seen for like lung and melanoma.
There's a lung doc, Dr. Jeremy Nadeau, who at a program we had not too long ago, has done a lot of work on this question. She felt that specifically dermatologic toxicity was associated with benefit. Any thoughts on that?
My thought is that she probably knows more than me about it, but may well be true.
Let's talk a little bit about complications of immunotherapy again in this particular setting. I think, you know, rash and endocrine issues, particularly thyroid, are what people particularly talk about, you know, occurring not insignificant number of patients. Any particularly interesting complications you've seen of IO at MGH there?
Yeah, you know, we're lucky enough to have an entire severe immunotherapy toxicity service, like a lot of, you know, big centers. And so the most humbling one to me, and honestly, the reason I attend on the service is sometimes when you give a lot of these drugs, you almost forget about how severe the side effects can be. And so in attending, when you see someone with toxic epidermonecrolysis or Stevens-Johnson syndrome or myocarditis that is life-threatening, you know, I think it's a reminder that we need to have a good informed consent discussions with the patients, because the vast majority of patients do great, but these things that we can induce are pretty scary, myositis in general. So I like to do it because it reminds me that, you know, these are not completely benign therapies, even though most patients do just fine.
You were telling me you're on the in-service right now. Any particularly interesting cases there?
Well, we happen to have a case of Stevens-Johnson right now, you know, really? After it's actually a lung cancer patient who got concurrent chemo PD-1 and really, you know, substantially in the ICU because of the degree of skin involvement, oral mucosa, et cetera. And it's, you know, a lot of immunosuppression, et cetera. You do everything you can try to do, but sometimes these are pretty serious.
So here's a question that I think has changed quite a bit over the last few years. And interestingly, it actually looks like there's a consensus here, which is the use of neoadjuvant IO in an MSI high patient. We've gone from really to everybody says they're open to it. And we had a couple of your papers on this in the Journal Club that maybe we can talk about. But what about the issue you were mentioning? You feel like all these localized patients need immediate MSI testing before they get even treated. What do we know about neoadjuvant IO in these patients?
Yeah, you know, I think MMR-deficient cancers share a biology, whether the anatomic site is the stomach or the rectum or the pancreas or the endometrium, and it's a biology that we've learned to leverage over the years with checkpoint inhibitors. And so we've taken learnings from our colorectal colleagues, our rectal colleagues who have more neoadjuvant experience doing this. There's just more patients. And now we actually have some data in stomach and esophagus. So there's basically two trials that have been presented and a third one that was presented at ESMO from Japan in MMR deficient or MSI high patients. And the take-home message is that drugs are very active. Very high rates of pathologic complete responses, like 60% of patients will have no residual disease at surgery. And these patients do very well. Their prognosis is very favorable. So on the back of that data in late August, the NCCN guidelines actually came out with an updated version that recommends one MSI testing for all stomach and esophagus adenos and squames, and incorporation of neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors as a strategy that is, you know, very supported, whether it's chemo plus PD-1 or PD-1 alone or PD-1 plus CTLA-4. I don't think we know exactly, but all of those approaches, I think exposure to neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors is really the message.
Anything you want to say about this presentation at the last GI meeting about neoadjuvant immunotherapy in these patients?
Yeah, it's really just adding more to the data. I think the totality of the data is all pointing in the same direction. I think we've seen support for PD-L1 strategies, PD-1 strategies, PD-1 plus CTLA-4 strategies. And really the message is just that this works. It's a high rate of path response. And so far, the early reporting that does seem to translate to a very impressive survival numbers. You know, these are not randomized studies, so we don't have control. But certainly these patients are doing exceptionally well.
How do you generally treat a patient with gastroesophageal cancer that's MSI high? Imagine these are mainly gastric, who has metastatic disease and no prior systemic therapy.
So great question. You know, we see this, if you look at the data, it's probably somewhere in the 3-5% range of patients who come in the door are going to be MSI high in the metastatic setting. But actually, if you look at the upper age strata, like people over the age of 80, which is not that uncommon in our patient population, it's as high as 30-40% are MMR deficient. And so I almost get excited for some of our older patients that, you know, they have a high chance of doing this because we have really effective therapy. But my own approach is definitely contains PD-1, whether it's with chemo or chemo-free. I think you can justify both. We've seen in KEYNOTE-62 the pembro alone arm, and we've seen sort of the summary of the KEYNOTE trials with MMR-deficient patients. I think if people have a high burden of disease, particularly liver metastases, I will include chemotherapy, and maybe that's a sort of a clinical pearl to some degree. You know, it looks like the liver mets are generally less responsive to immunotherapy approaches across tumors. And so I do think in people with liver involvement, I do tend to give chemotherapy. Also, people with big, bulky tumors that are very symptomatic or a lot of burden of disease, I think there is some additional benefit to maybe just a general debulking of the disease in MMR deficient. But if someone has a low volume of disease, I will often reach for a checkpoint inhibitor alone and then maybe consider the addition of chemotherapy if things are not going well, although admit there's not a lot of data for that. But definitely checkpoint inhibitor exposure and in combination with FOLFOX or alone, I think are both defensible.
How about anti-CTLA-4?
Yeah, the arm of CheckMate 649 that included ipi/nivo. Of course, there were some MSI high patients in that, and the outcomes for those patients were quite good. And we've also seen from some of the older data with ipi/nivo with the rare MSI patients that they tend to have very high response rates. So I think it's a very active combination. There's no data, to my knowledge, that it's any better than monotherapy, but I don't think we actually have the head-to-head data in gastric and esophageal. So certainly that the toxicity rates are higher. There is some data about salvaging MMR stable disease or low or lack of response with adding checkpoints, some anecdotes. So I personally don't do a lot of upfront PD-1, CTLA-4 for MSI high patients, but there is some data out there, and it's very active combination.
So of course I hear some great stories of response to immunotherapy and MSI high, but also a lot of questions about patients who just don't respond at all. I mean, I think maybe in almost half of them may not respond. It seems counterintuitive. I was fascinated, but I didn't know anything about this. A paper you have looking at ascites as a mechanism of resistance. Can you kind of go through that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation that I think a few people have kind of made over the years about ascites. So peritoneal disease and ascites is quite common in gastric cancer. You know, estimates around 40% of our patients will develop peritoneal disease and ascites at some point, whether it's in the beginning or third line. And so this was really an effort, since none of us have a ton of MSI patients due to the frequency. We kind of pooled our international resources, you know, led by some Italian colleagues, to look at this question. And we just collected a whole bunch of clinical data. And one of the things that fell out was patients who had ascites had substantially less benefit, even when we tried to control for other factors that come with ascites. And the thinking is that probably the soup of the acidic fluid is quite immunosuppressive. I think there's some data for this in some translational studies, but certainly it does seem to bear out clinically. So it's something, again, that's a population where I would clinically reach for chemotherapy plus checkpoint inhibitor in someone with MMR deficient disease and ascites, sort of based on this global experience.
Any other big reasons why people with MSI high don't respond? I've heard people talk about whether it's germline or not, or the type of MSI. Is that predictive?
Yeah, I think, you know, one humbling thing about stomach and esophagus cancer, at least in my own opinion, is that these are among the most heterogeneous tumors that I think any of us see in terms of HER2 regions. You know, have a HER2 region here that's positive, over here is negative, PD-L1 high here, low here. I actually think that we're learning that sporadic, you know, somatic MMR deficiency may share some of these features in stomach, where you may have regions of the tumor that are actually MSS, and maybe 80% are MSI high. So you do generate a great response, but there is a fair amount of residual tumor. I think germline patients, the thinking is this may be a little bit different proportion, where every cell has the defect. And at least some anecdotes I've seen have suggested maybe higher response rates in germline in gastric and esophageal MSI high patients. There's also an interesting preclinical paper from Tyler Jack's lab in Nature Genetics that was looking at the clonality of the neoantigens, whether these are shared across all the clones or whether the neoantigen is subclonal in the setting of MSI high. And this is getting a little beyond the clinic, but the high clonal neoantigen are really the patients who are doing the best. And so we don't have a routine test to assess the clonality of the neoantigens, but certainly it's very interesting scientifically to think that these are some of the modulators of response in MSI high patients.
We did a post-ESMO meeting last week on GYN. We're talking about POLE, which I guess has even more mutations than MSI high. Do you see POLE in GI tumors?
Definitely see it in GI cancers. I don't think I've ever seen one in stomach or esophagus, but certain colorectal, pancreas, you know, across the spectrum of GI cancers, the POLE mutations have been described and are, you know, generally exquisitely sensitive to checkpoint inhibition. But I personally have not seen one in stomach or esophagus.
So let's finish out with a little bit more of the survey. We were talking about HER2 positive disease. And as you can see, the scenario we're talking about in terms of second-line therapy, either post-TOGA or post-811, either way, the faculty in general is thinking about TDXD second-line. But I'm curious, and last night we actually did a webinar with you, included your colleague in lung, Dr. Piotrowska, and of course we were talking all about TDXD there, and there, HER2 mutant disease. And of course, one of the things we talk about whenever we talk about TDXD is interstitial lung disease. Can you kind of reflect back on your experience with ILD in patients with gastroesophageal cancer? And it looks like you buy into the usual algorithm that if they do develop ILD and asymptomatic, okay, maybe rechallenge, but not if they're symptomatic. Can you just kind of reflect in general on what you think about in terms of ILD?
Yeah, I think, you know, for any drug, it's particularly important to learn some of the unique toxicity profiles when they exist. As you suggested, you know, nausea and vomiting with zolbetuximab, ILD with trastuzumab deruxtecan, et cetera. And I think that, one, there's been actually a pretty good job across the community of areas where TDXD has improved about educating people and, you know, clinicians and patients about what to watch for. So, you know, kudos to all the trials and all the investigators for really making an effort to get it out there. I have seen this. I've, you know, given plenty of TDXD, and sometimes it's a totally incidental radiographic finding. And, you know, in our patient population, where there's often a lot of coexisting issues, sometimes aspiration, this is a little bit hard to tease out. So in that setting, where the patient is benefiting and we don't have a lot of other good options, I will continue that in an asymptomatic patient for the most part. As you see, I think there's general agreement that when patients have symptomatic ILD or extensive involvement of the lung, we're really probably taking a risk of continuing on that trajectory, and we will stop and often not rechallenge in that scenario. I have seen one or two cases where, you know, this was quite debilitating and took some time to recover. I have not personally had anyone experience, you know, death from interstitial lung disease, although that has been reported. So I think I generally follow the guidelines for most of the trials for this, which it looks like kind of everybody does too.
So a final question, of course, anytime we talk about TDXD, we got to talk about HER2-low. I think I'm starting to see data outside of breast, at least looking at this. I think maybe there's some responses that have been reported. Of course, it looks like people are kind of not exactly ready to do it. But you say if you have the right patient, what's the right patient?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in Destiny Gastric 01, the original TDXD gastroesophageal trial from Dr. Shatara, they actually had a cohort of HER2-low, and there was within the HER2-low, there was two groups. There was like 2+ by IHC, but FISH negative, so technically HER2 negative, and then there was like 0-1 and ISH positive. And in the HER2 2+ FISH negative population, the response rate was around 25%, and in the other group, it was like 10 or 11. And so if I had to choose someone who couldn't get Taxol or could not get RAM for some contraindications, poor blood pressure, bowel obstruction, et cetera, you know, I would think about this. I think there is a lot to be learned and some ongoing trials, particularly in the HER2-low space, maybe even TDXD plus ramucirumab, for example, in someone who couldn't get Taxol and RAM and HER2-low. So I think lot to learn. Certainly, it does appear promising from other tumor types, but in general, we don't act on HER2-low in gastric and esophageal yet.
It's really interesting, though. I wonder where it's going to head. Do you think that TDXD is going to end up with a pan-tumor approval?
I think they can make a case. I think there's a lot of, you know, we may see this for TROP2 someday. We may see this for some FGFR2 inhibitors. I think this may already be coming. So I think if the biology is there and the drug is active, you know, I would want to have that available even in, you know, diseases where it's going to be very hard to do a prospective trial.
I was just flashing on the fact that at San Antonio, we're doing an entire symposium just on HER2-low. So there's a lot to talk about. Anyhow, Sam, thank you. Thanks so much for working with us, Sam. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back on November 29th. We'll hear what Dr. Goyal and Javly have to say about biliary tract cancer, or particularly whether, again, IOs are going to be part of first-line therapy. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Sam.